Tom Ewing, and this is Freaky Trigger and the Lollards of Pop. It's noon. It's Sunday, the 10th of March, and you're listening to Resonance FM at the start of its broadcast day. We're broadcasting this lunchtime live from the twisting corridors of the notorious Maze of Zagor, armed only with a coil of theoretical string, some iron rations, and a dodgy 5-foot pole. Is there hope of escape? Probably not, but at least we'll go down talking. On today's show, we'll be examining the enduring strength of genre as an idea and questioning the intelligence of challenging art. We'll compare the performing wisdom of Joan Jett and Bing Crosby in real time, relying on our engineer's dexterity to steer us between the beats. We'll discover how the radical constitution that secretly underpins school stories was forged by the wicked charisma of Storky & Co. And as some of you might have just guessed, we'll also be talking Dungeons & Dragons. All leavened with musical selections and leading up to the weekly exclusive announcement of Britain's number one single. Your Lollards today are Mark Sinker.
Hello.
Magnus Anderson.
Hello.
And joined for the first time by Alex Thompson.
Hello.
Pete Barron will be manning the dials of steel.
And doing a bad job of it, probably.
But first, what has gone before? Nonsense, when all is said and done, is still nonsense. But the study of nonsense, that is science. Freaky Trigger, the one internet collective that passes its sanity check. Drop science, so you can pick it back up again. Castle Trigger has been a buzz this week, as the annual ritual of Glastonbury application got rolling, and we wrote something gushing about Carter USM. Some things never change, but other things do. Earlier in the week, there was some excitement over a list, published by BBC Talking Point, of things that had changed in Britain over the last 10 years. Things like, beach huts used to be for grandads, not property speculators. Oh. Magnus, as a property speculator... If you just returned to Britain after a 10-year absence, what would you notice?
Well, I suppose the first thing that it would occur to me to notice is that if there was an article which appeared on the BBC website, which was considered the most important and most read article of that day, you might have expected a journalist to have written it all by themselves. In fact, it looks like the job that they had with this article was simply to pin down those comments that were made by the readers, which were so inoffensive, or at least sufficiently inoffensive, that they were allowed to publish them on this website. But some of them, even still, I think are somewhat near the mark, I think. The one that really struck me was, Marmite now comes in a squeezy jar. And I think that's an innovation we actually got from Australia.
Yeah, I think Vegemite came in a squeezy jar first. So,
but in general, what you're saying is that the nation's broadcast institutions have been taken over by random lunatics drawn from the internet.
It's journalism 2.0.
Yeah, culture's been outsourced to idiots. Hurrah, we won!
And we love it. Alex, you live... Well, Scotland is still part of Britain, but that's where you live. And you've now just returned to London to appear on this fine show.
Yes, that's right. After a three-month absence.
After a two-week absence. What have you noticed has changed?
I think if I had to look back, the thing that would strike me would be the disappearance of the phone box and the fact that people were...
Is it connected to the return of Doctor Who?
Yes, they've all been kidnapped.
Have they all been stolen by Spanish kids?
I mean, the mobile phone, though, of course, is around everywhere. So, clearly in Australia, this person was coming back from Australia after 10 years. And since half of Australian TV is just British TV, they'll probably have noticed all these things anyway. So, I mean, they'll be well aware that phone boxes, mobile phones exist. So,
yes, the
phone boxes might go.
The cultural exchange between Britain and Australia is fairly well established.
Yeah.
Freaky Trigger also this week would have marked the passing of French philosopher Jean Baudrillard, except his headlines were stolen by the assassination of fictional character Captain America. Alex, you've tangled with Baudrillard's thinking before. What sort of legacy has the man left?
It's hard to say, really.
Okay, well, you could talk about Captain Scotland instead. That was the other question.
The thing that most interested me about the death of Baudrillard was the difference between the reception in Britain and America and that in France, because France had instantly became a battle over the legacy of kind of radical critique as an idea, and in Britain and America, everyone just went, well, he was in the Matrix, so he must be cool.
Yes, that's true, but I think Captain America is much more important, because when Baudrillard was shot on the court, at the steps of the court, you know, people, it was an assassination that people would care about, whereas Captain America being shot in that way, you know, it's...
Any thoughts on the death of Captain America from our panellists?
I thought Baudrillard took it far too far.
No, I think the answer is no, actually.
No. He's not really dead.
I wanted to bring... Obviously, to bring in my only real cultural bedrock, which is that the problem I always had with Baudrillard is that he, I think, is essentially the author of the Muskrat's favourite book on the uselessness of everything. And since obviously
the Muskrat,
the Muskrat in Moomin Valley, who is a ne'er-do-well philosopher who sponges off the Moomins for several books. Complaining about things.
That's what philosophers
do. His favourite book is called On the Uselessness of Everything, but at a particular point it gets lost and he gets granted one wish, which is to have his book back, and it comes back called On the Usefulness of Everything, and he says, but this wasn't my book. And the hobgoblin who grants the wish merely laughs.
Tom, did Baudrillard walk around with a big B on his head? Because obviously the thing about Captain America, which I always loved, was the fact that his costume, whilst it was red, white and blue, was symbolising the American Stars and Stripes, but he also had a big A on his head, just in case you didn't work out that he was Captain America.
He was operating behind enemy lines in Germany, so obviously some kind of cunning disguise. as Captain Austria, maybe.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Captain would Australia. Have been quite useful. Yeah, Captain Australia, indeed.
Or Captain Andorra, which would be like 15% of the actual population. So.
He also had wings on his head,
yes,
of course, which I think may have meant to represent the American Eagle's wings, but they were a bit smaller than any, maybe an American Eagle chick.
They weren't useful, were they?
And finally, the belly-warming success story of the week on Freaky Trigger is Reggae Reggae Sauce, which is now on your supermarket shelf after its inventor triumphed on TV show Dragon's Den. And it begs the question... What would other music sauces taste like? Mark, any takers for an improv sauce?
Well, improv, in a sense, there's nothing which isn't improv sauce. I was interested in the idea of what dub reggae sauce it might be. And I think it's when you bang the bottom of the jar for it to come out and nothing happens for a really long
time. Well, speaking of banging the bottom of the jar, we actually have in the studio some reggae reggae sauce, which
it's very nice. Tom has just poured on the floor.
Studio, we do mean
it's very pop reggae. It comes out without banging the bottom of the jar at all.
Magnus is now going to open the Doritos and I'm going to ingest some raw reggae sauce by licking my fingers of the residue before it goes on the
just tip it into
studio.
The Doritos.
Yeah,
how about
Fury? It's
onto your trousers and the floor.
Is it a cooking sauce or is it a? This is listeners. You need to see this. Unfortunately, you can't. So half Dorito out.
It's very tasty. It is actually very tasty. Yes. Good work, Dragon's Den.
I mean, is it spicy? I can't reach because I'm on the knobs. And it would be dangerous
to
put the sauce.
It's much milder than that. Oh, my God, it's got an aftertaste.
Yes, it has got an aftertaste. But,
but it's a nice
thumbs up, Dragon's Den. Thumbs up modern global capitalism and the entrepreneurial spirit. We're having a dissenting voice from the bastion of left resistance over there.
Well, it's very tasty, but I can't help feeling that the secret code message that they're actually trying to sell this on is this has ganja in it.
Mm.
What are you trying to say?
Shelves of Sainsbury's.
What are you trying to say about reggae, Alex? Is it a direct link between reggae and the smoking of marijuana?
I'm making no suggestion at all, except that perhaps in the public mind the two may be connected.
I think all successful.
I suggest tipping that dangerous container of radioactive sauce into the Doritos.
Right, okay.
Not onto the floor.
All successful products sell themselves on the assumption that they're full of drugs.
Like, yes.
Obviously, Coca-Cola.
Yep.
HB sauce. Yep. The H stands for heroin. Yeah, please.
And the tamarind is a source of an illegal drug anyway, I'm sure.
Dr. Drugs is on assignment in Colombia this week, so he can't comment on this latest front.
MMDA.
War on drugs. MMDA.
MMDA
sauce.
Yeah.
So, yes, but it's got a zing to it, it's got a kick to it.
Very, it's quite nice, actually.
Very
it's
reggae-ish.
Very like HB fruity sauce, but still.
All this talk of sauce has left me thirsty for music.
That's a link, isn't it?
Here's Alex's choice. Cheap Trick's Surrender.
Mother told me
Surrender. Alex, can you talk us through what's going on in that song?
Yes, Tom. Well, the reason I love that song is because it kind of turns rock and roll perspective right round in on itself, in that rather than telling you to rebel against your parents, this song is saying, actually, they can offer you some really quite useful advice.
Given that it's about a teenager walking in on his parents shagging, what kind of advice were you thinking?
Do not disturb on the door.
Well, obviously the premise of the song is that Mummy warned me that I'd meet girls like you, and instead of saying, yes, excellent, this is going to really annoy them, it's actually, yes, so sorry, love, I'm not going to go anywhere where near you. And as Tom, you say, the turning point in the song actually turns back in on itself and becomes a reflection on rock and roll itself, because Mummy and Daddy are rock and rolling, literally on the couch, they're rolling numbers, and to the great dismay of the subject of the song, they've got his Kiss records out. So this is music for everyone, and it's music that tells you the wrong message too.
So what he thought was his own personal music, the sudden universality of it, or at least the parentality of it, is a bit of a shocker.
Yes, that's right, that's right. And if you like, after this point, rock and roll becomes something completely different.
This track changed rock and roll. Oh, for him, in the song.
Yes, it's a change that's always there. He just has to change his perspective. He has to surrender but not give himself away.
But this track still has time to change rock and roll.
Well, any track has time to change rock and roll.
Well, every track does change rock and roll, and that's the nature of how it works as an art form.
Heavy. What does it tell us about genre as an idea? Well, not what do you think about genre?
Well, because kind of, if you like, the interesting thing is that it's not radically different in being kind of self-reflexive and asking about the nature of rock and roll and who it's for and what it's doing. And that, for me, that is the essence of every art form always carries within it, as a reflection on genre and the nature of genre, these kinds of things.
Well,
no, I was just going to say that. I mean, for me, genre is basically a system for kind of managing the social relations inherent in the artwork.
A more concrete example, maybe.
Well, if you like, the concrete example is that we don't necessarily go to artworks to have our perceptions change. We like to know what we're getting. If you think about the way that a bookshop is organised, it's not just simply that there's proper fiction over here and then old books here and books for girls over here, but this actually serves a social function of keeping the teenagers away from the adults. You don't have to choose your book from the same section, and that kind of confirms your sense of yourself and sense of being different.
And keeping the adults away from the teenagers, which is what's breaking down in that Kiss song.
That's right. It's the sense that actually this is kind of radically open, and anyone can participate in rock and rolling.
So when they want to have a Harry Potter book in both children and the adult section, they need to specifically say so by having two different copies of it.
That's right. This is something that I think all writers, all artists are very aware of. They know that to actually be visible, they have to articulate themselves in generic terms. So it's not something that comes afterwards, the evil marketing manager comes in and says, no, you must sell this to this person. It's exactly what they think about when they go to create it. And Ian Banks is the great example of this, as someone who writes Ian Banks and Ian M. Banks novels going completely to different audiences. And he's happy with the requirements of both genres, you know,
the
literary fiction.
Even more rubbish.
It's a terrific trick, though. There are all the letters in the alphabet, and you can have as many genres as he wants.
Are there that many genres? Sorry, Mark.
I was there's a documentary I'm reviewing for Sight and Sound, which is about the underground movie phenomenon at the end of the 60s, and there's sort of two little items which are relevant to this. One is that the films that they're talking about, which were big underground hits in the sense that they were showing off the standard cinema circuit, the documentary is called Midnight Movies, and they were actually showing at midnight, and they were, some of them were at the same cinema for 10 years, with people coming back at the weekend at midnight, year in, year out, to watch them. So they were a word of mouth success. But what the people who are commenting on it are often saying is that what the viewer was so excited was that they didn't know what they were getting when they first saw Pink Flamingos or El Topo, that they had no idea how to process it, and they found this actually very exhilarating. But it also cuts to the kind of negative side of that, which is that Roger Ebert talking about trying to justify the very bad review he gave of to Night of the Living Dead, said, well, I saw it at a children's matinee and these 10-year-olds were weeping with fear, and I felt this was a bad thing. And it's not hard to feel that, you know, that there are sensible lines that you don't want to cross with, especially today, that culture is relatively unfiltered in ways that it wasn't in the 60s, but that also there is something very exciting about not being terribly sure what the genre is, that in itself is stimulating. And then in fact it's one of the reasons why the charts are potentially exciting, is that you will encounter something where you don't really know what it is and you don't know how you're meant to respond to it, but you have you're drawn to it and you don't know why. In other words, you don't feel that your response is kind of predetermined.
Do you think it's kind of a conservative force then, genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think often you get the situation where people are going out to buy books because they like books like this book. So they're not actually looking to be challenged in that way. They're looking to actually have something that they understand the rules of.
But I think there is a great danger to the argument that it's a conservative force, on the grounds that, yes, this is a necessary way of managing our relations. And one of the great transformations in the way we think about art occurs in the late 18th century, and it's the idea that there could be art which is without genre and therefore is somehow better, because it is kind of a kind of radical opening of the self. And this leads very rapidly not only to looking down on generic forms, but it becomes a genre in itself, which claims to be challenging you, but in fact isn't challenging you at all. I was very struck last time I was down in London, you know, reading through the listings. I saw an art exhibition that described itself as challenging and provocative, and it was an exhibition on the victims of prostitution, and it was, I'm going to caricature it grotesquely, but it was held at the kind of Centre for Angry Women Studies and their nice liberal husbands. And it's clear that the people going to see this are not going to be challenged. And I think that's the sense that they will be looking down on mere entertainment because it's not challenging is a real problem. And if you like, one of the things I like about the Cheap Trick song is that it's saying, you know, that thinking that you're, you know, somehow the only one who has access to rebellion because you have a particular genre is always going to be a failure. Yeah.
Do you think though that when genre gets out in the world and sort of starts becoming part of a person's identity, and that's when it starts getting, you know, because genres challenge one another, like people get beat up based on whether they're a goth or an emo or a chav. The compulsory emo mentioned this week.
But of course, great culture is about transcending this, and Romeo and Juliet is basically a story of the love affair between an emo and an indie, and the rest of these
Shakespeare
parties.
Invented it all, didn't?
But I mean, when we talk about genre, we're talking about art, obviously. But surely, you know, the reggae sauce is in itself a genre. I mean, it's when we opened the bottle, it was like, okay, well, this is a Jamaican sauce, it's a jerk sauce, but it's going to be hot. You know, we the
challenging and provocative.
Yeah, we had assumptions about how the sauce would taste before we tasted it, and whilst it fitted within those assumptions, it also did some things that we didn't expect. So I mean, and the idea of taking the idea of genre into other fields, I think, is really interesting, and actually probably elucidates the idea about where genre goes wrong, or the conversation of genre goes wrong.
Can you kind of jam or subvert a genre?
I think that's another one of those, if you like, the problem with the way we think about genre is that we tend to, or that certain ways of talking about it privilege writing or music which claims to subvert genre. But in fact, that's simply the way that all genres work. An artwork starts from a genre, articulates its relation to that genre, but that's always a question of tension, because it can't simply be a copy of what's gone before it. It's always adapting, thrusting, pushing at the boundaries. And again, the idea that there's a genre of works which subvert genre is a pretty miserable and kind of poverty-stricken way of looking at the world.
Well, could you strip a medium of its genre if you removed all its labels? If you went into a food shop and took all the labels off the jars of various sauces and just said, go and eat this, or remove the cover from all of the books.
When you open a can of beans, though, it's still going to look like a can of beans.
Yes. I mean, I think with food, we do have a natural genreification device, which is like our nose and our eyes and stuff like that, is that we
also we have four genres of taste buds built into
five.
Our mouths.
Yeah,
five. Forget, sorry,
you're forgetting umami. My favourite story on this is I made some celeriac soup last year, and when it came out, it looked just like Heinz apple sauce. And so as I ate it, you know, there was this real tension within me between it actually tasting a bit like apple sauce, but that was just in my head. In my mouth, it tasted like quite a manky celeriac soup. But
it's what Lush, the cosmetics company, they, by making things that look like lovely, delicious cakes and smell like lovely, delicious cakes and actually would cause you enormous upsetting grief. They're kind of, you know, dancing this tango of between consumer genres. That's why they're...
Yeah, and yes. Certainly, yeah.
That's why they're so successful, I guess. Or part of.
So, yeah. to get concrete with music again, the
not concrete
song
music.
Song that I've chosen is a classic blues song which has been covered, if that's the right word, by string quartet. And I guess the thing that I'm a bit sort of baffled by is what's it for? What's the use of doing this? Mm. And it seems to me that it is a you know, a genre jam. Sorry, that was the spirit of Baudrillard speaking to me briefly. But I don't, you know, if you say, well, clearly it isn't particularly confrontational. You just put it. It's a record. You put it on. I don't see how that's confrontational.
Should we put it on now?
Why not?
Oh yeah,
have a listen. Quartet with a cover of Spoonful, originally a Willie Dixon song. As a kind of genre play, what did you think of that, Alex?
I mean Mark kind of was worrying about this before the record played, but I think it's an example of the, you know, a fallacy, which is that genres are somehow fixed units, and that bringing two together is in some way going to subvert or reshape the way people think the world. And that's just clearly not the case. The genres look fixed, or they feel fixed, and that's why they give us the security. But if I can just get in a plug for one of my favourite critics of genre, which is Chuck Eddy. In his book, The Accidental Evolution of Rock and Roll, he takes great pleasure in showing that actually genres are always in motion. And so that...
Right. An example of what he does?
Well, he'll show, if you like, the sense that, you know, the key genre idea might be long song, so which cuts across rock, disco, the kind of boundaries that people are drawing up, as you were saying, you know, in school they want to fit into a certain category. And he's saying, you know, we can keep reshaping and kind of shaking up these ideas.
So the thing being that we need category, but we don't need it to be the thing that was laid down in the 1790s. And in fact, not only do we not need it, it's nothing like that.
I think that's right, and just in the same sense, what the artist does is negotiate between the generic situation in which they work and the desire to do something different, to shape up the genre they're in and push it towards other genres. We can live like that too. In other words, we don't need to complete just follow a pattern. It's helpful, as you say, categories make sense of life for us and they're very useful things, but we have the option to kind of recognise that they're constantly evolving and changing, and that's how, you know, life is a genre. And I constantly remake my life, and I remake life in general at the same time.
The thing that I think I would think about, just to tie up on the Chronos, is that the way I get something out of that is to think of them as working musicians exploring things, and what decisions went into making it sound like that, in order to, you know, how did they decide to write it that way, to make it that, how did they study the music in the first place, and to think through that aspect of it, which I think is kind of the opposite of subversion, really. It is a kind of analysis, and I suppose it's a kind of critical analysis, but it's not about bringing a better sense of value to a damaged thing, whatever direction that flow is meant to is assumed to be going.
And it can show a commonality which was already there.
Do you think people have genres? Do you find yourself fitting into the do you feel you fit into the genre of academic, and do you feel yourself needing to push against that genre or embrace it? Or
I'm a Gemini. So I mean, my answer to that is definitely yes. And although I'm a bit sort of, I don't actually know any of the other astrological genres at all well. I can't remember what Capricorns are or anything, but I'm definitely a Gemini.
Yeah. And certainly it helps in articulating your relation with students, say, if you remember that you can belong to the genre academic and deploy some of the techniques that go along with that, like pretending that you can't work a video player. Very helpful in establishing certain kinds of rapport and kind of reassuring everyone and preparing the grounds for a kind of dialogue and conversation.
And getting people to set the video for you.
That's not the genre academic, that's the genre granddad.
we were planning to do some talking over records, but owing to glitches with the headphones, we've realised that the records might be played, but we wouldn't be able to hear them while we were talking over them, which would indeed have made for some quite radical radical radio, but possibly not a particularly great listening experience. So we're in fact just going to play one of the records we were going to talk over and not talk over it. And it's a great record, and it's a Christmas record, which is extremely appropriate for the second week in March. So let's hear it.
Too late before the
That was Joan Jett performing, of course, Little Drummer Boy. We can leave genre behind, but it won't always leave us. A shared experience unites our panel this week, on this side of the mixing desk at least. All of us went to public school. In my case, I was a boarder, and I had some pretty strong and quite frightening ideas before I went as to what it might be like, mostly taken from Rudyard Kipling's classic school story, Storky & Co. Mark, can you briefly explain what the book's about?
It's a book about three boys at a school which is not, I think, technically a public school. It's more like a
Borstal.
It's still too posh for me, Mark.
It was a sort of crammer for army kids, really, and it's semi-autobiographical. The school it was based on is actually is in an old Lollard place of meme, which is Westwood Ho with an exclamation mark. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression. What I think it's about is it's taking the classic school genre of the 19th century, which was by then very well established and popular, in which the children of empire were trained to become the leaders of this vast imperium, and it looks at what it actually takes to do that. Now, the genre as it had established is quite sententious and tiresome and moralistic. It had begun by with Tom Brown's School Days, and it was very Christian. The author of Tom Brown's School Days was a part of a movement calling themselves Muscular Christians. And his idea was that the point of the empire had no point unless it was a moral guide to the world. And the children would be shaped to go out and run. Was it several thousand men in charge of millions and millions of people?
Was it a genre that was written for the people who were in those schools? I mean, was it written in that way?
Yeah, I think it worked as a kind of promotional tool, really. And some of the schools, the school in Tom Brown's School Days is a real school, which was Rugby. And he was describing his own school days, although I think rather sentimentalised.
Later on, though, it wasn't. I mean, the school story of the of the early 20th century, the kind of Billy Bunter, Greyfriars.
I think by then it had become very generic, but it was clearly, it was of the type. And the idea was that you wouldn't get to... I think it was important...
It was read by people well beyond people who were at those schools, though.
But I think there was always an aspirational aspect to it. And if you based it in Rugby, then you would read it and be disappointed you wouldn't get to Rugby, which obviously is only so big. So you read it about Greyfriars, and then got to a school which was sort of Greyfriars-ish.
Though, of course, there's the big issue about literacy, of course, because previously to then, the people who went to public school were the majority of literate people in the country, whereas when you get the poor schools and the free schools in the early 20th century, then suddenly you open up the literate audience, though they may not be at schools like that, so...
The thing that Arnold and his the like actually pretty much insisted on was setting the selection up so that the people coming to those schools were literate. Mm. In the 18th century, the idea that it was the literate part of the country would be laughable.
Yeah.
It was the children of
the knobs,
you know, squires around the country who all they cared about was drinking and hunting and other...
But Kipling, I mean, we can't say, oh, he subverted the school story.
I think what he introduces is the idea that actually for the empire to work well and for the for this imperium to be as solid and as strong as it needed this anarchic energy of people who really didn't care about hierarchy at all and so who were their own masters.
He's a kind of management guru or sort of theorist. It's like...
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he was. I mean, he was only interested in the management of empire. He wasn't interested in the management of a another corporation.
Tom, as the poor boy around the table, as the one who didn't go to public school, can we have a public school roll call? You know, where did everyone go here?
I went to Winchester.
I went to a school called Latimer, which isn't actually a public school because there's some very narrow definition which defines it.
It's not one of the big nine, no. Is what Magnus is embarrassingly trying to confess.
Not even really a school in that case.
No, that's right. It's what I'm proudly using to look up to you all. It was actually quite a mixed school. It was based in London, so I think it was
mixed in the sense of having girls.
It is now. No, not then.
Heaven forbid.
No, God no.
A shocking development in the genre.
Mixed in the sense of having the upper middle class and the upper middle class.
pretty much. It was slightly broader than that, but yeah.
I was another member of the elite nine in that I was at Winchester as well.
And Mark?
Yeah, mine's one of the nine as well. I think it just means they're old. It's a Tudor foundation, Shrewsbury.
And of course, I went to Nicholas Hawke's more comprehensive school, which doesn't exist anymore. So, I just think it's interesting. I mean, it's a different world in so many ways, and the fiction obviously reinforces that in some ways. It allows you to know in advance some of these things. You know, that when you go there, there will be the fagging and all that kind of stuff, which obviously to me is an alien world. But
there wasn't fagging by the time we were.
My experience of it was that it was very, very unlike the fictional version of it, which was by then quite old. The school, these kind of schools, went through quite a big change in the late 50s and early 60s because the Empire had shut down and their old function was in fact no longer required, and they had to adjust quite a lot to what their purpose was.
Certainly when we were there, there was quite a consciousness amongst the boys to some extent of not wanting to do things the old way, and there was a kind of element which didn't want to play up the more hierarchical associations of the system, but we may have been slightly unusual there.
Does the genre still exist?
The biggest selling children's book, the biggest selling children's book of the last decade is a school story. It's a school story in which the pupils are wizards.
But it is public school-esque, even though probably public schools aren't very like Hogwarts.
Unlikely. I would say that certain aspects of Hogwarts are still being perpetuated in public school. But there are other things, I guess, which might be. But
even prior to that, there was... before the change that you're talking about in the 50s and 60s, there were much more anodyne versions of the genre. There were the Jennings books by Anthony Buckridge, which were... I always loved them. They was kind of like very softened. There was no real sense of hierarchy other than that they were the teachers and the senior boys. But there wasn't sort of fagging or particular abuse or anything like that.
Do you think hierarchy is an important part of the school story?
Well, yes, I think it's essential, and it's essential because it's what you're trying to compare is the hierarchy of establishment and the hierarchy and a sort of moral hierarchy of, you know, the hero, and the way the stories work is that essentially someone is put in a position of power, a teacher or a prefect or a bully, who doesn't for some reason deserve it, but the institution appears to be behind him, and then as the drama unfolds, the person who is rightly the hero by being nice and good and the one we identify overthrows that. What's interesting in the Stalky ones is that it's much more uneasy how closely you can actually identify with Stalky's behaviour, because
yes, he's a bit of a...
Well, they're hooligans in a lot of ways, and the story where they defeat the horrible bullies, they do so essentially by capturing them and torturing them hideously at great length with a tremendous grisly enjoyment in these tortures he's describing, which were probably real and probably had happened to him as a child.
It's interesting, actually. The longest continually published school story in this country is, of course, the Bash Street Kids, which appears weekly in the Beano, and that similarly was begun by a communist, whose name I've completely forgotten, Leo Baxendale, of course, and it was designed to, you know, provide kids with a weekly dose of anti-authority subversion of teacher, and he used to get into huge running battles with the Beano editors because he was their most popular cartoonist and best loved, and every issue teacher had to win, and so Baxendale would attempt to kind of make teacher win in such a way that it showed teacher up to be a complete fool. And to make the kind of enormous sort of kinetic double page spreads of the kids rioting hugely more enticing and enjoyable than the kind of cramped single panel at the end where teacher has.
But of course, I mean, I could empathise with the Bass Street kids because it was a comprehensive. It was that kind of thing.
I'm not sure they ever say.
Well, no, I'm pretty sure it wasn't.
It's not a boarding school.
And it's long pre. Yeah. Comprehensive when it was actually. It's
possibly yes. All right. It was
actually introduced in the Attlee government. The strip.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. So yeah.
It was part of their the form. You know, the swathing changes that the Attlee government brought in. One of the things was the Bass Street kids.
That and the NHS, the two things that were.
And only one of them is still working.
I think it's time for another song. Not a school song. This is another cover version. And it's Nouvelle Vague's.
School song. Oh,
yeah. Nouvelle Vague's Making Plans for Nigel. Making Plans for Nigel by Nouvelle Vague. Magnus, that Nigel in that song, well, in the XTC original and in that kind of slightly dreamier meditation on it, he's getting his life choices made for him. That's the point of it, and it's very much from a kind of era when, you know, a job for life. Once Nigel had chosen to be a steel worker, well, he wouldn't have been an actual steel worker, but a kind of middle management at British Steel, that would have been it, and he couldn't change. Does that remind you of anything?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Tom. The subject I wanted to sort of bring in was something which I suspect a lot of people around this mixing desk have had their hand in, which is role-playing games. These are sort of improvised radio shows which are played with... well, I don't know how else to describe them. They're rules-based plays, which were improvised by the players, normally teenage boys or younger, and were particularly popular in the 80s, and were very genre-focused, so they almost were always fantasy games and were occasionally sci-fi games.
The classic example being Dungeons & Dragons.
Absolutely. And one of the key aspects of these is that the games came complete with a set of rules which had a kind of prescriptive professional determinism. So you were allocated, or you allocated for yourself, a job which would define your entire personality, which was probably quite handy for the age groups it was aimed at, which were early teens and so on. But it seems bizarre to us now. I mean, when you and I talk to each other, Tom, the fact that you're a scuba diving instructor and I'm a bouncy castle repairman rarely comes up in our conversation. You might just imagine.
I think it should more often, actually, because they're quite interesting things.
Not when you actually get down to it.
The job's a job, isn't it?
Exactly, job's a job, mate.
So, Magnus, you're saying that you were prescribed a kind of character, that even though there isn't a script for the improvisation, it being an improvisation, I suppose, you're given cues and tips, but it's based on the assumption that, you know, you are defined by your work profession.
I don't think it's too weird, though, because, I mean, when you're growing up, you know, you do get asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you don't say, well, I'm thinking of doing, like, 3 years as an astronaut, and then in today's mobile labour market, I'm going to be a train driver, and then maybe a fireman. You tend to kind of... I believe I chose gravy taster.
And you still do that.
A dream.
Yeah, it could happen. So what were the jobs, Magnus? What were the jobs that you could do in the original game?
Well, the original version of this game, it was very straightforward. You were basically either the butch fighter, or you were what they called a magic user, which was kind of the geek technician.
Wizard.
Or there would be kind of like slight variations on it, but really it was sort of a straightforward allocation by personality type married to a job role. And I think this was put in place by the inventors of the game, partly because it made the game mechanic work quite well, but also because I suspect there was a kind of control freakery going on. I think people who created this world didn't really like the idea that it would be too anarchic and that people would be able to just go off and decide what they wanted to be. But that didn't stop them from actually creating their own job types. And as the game became more advanced and sort of periphery journals and fanzines contributed to it, there'd be an increasing range of jobs that you could take on. And famously, one of the ones that appeared in the very first issue of White Dwarf, which was a role-playing game magazine, was for the pervert.
Yes, I mean, essentially what you would do is you would sit down and say, right, in this game I'm going to be a fighter or a magic user. And so the idea would be, well, in this game I'm going to be a pervert. And it being played by 12 and 13-year-old boys, the list of skills that a pervert possesses in this issue of White Dwarf are things like flashing, peeping, and strangely, graffiti artist.
What year was this?
1977.
All right, things have changed a bit since then, hopefully.
Yeah, perversions have developed enormously.
I mean, part of the reason to do this, of course, is that once they've sold you the game, they can keep selling you stuff. So
yes, they can sell you a kind of handbook called, you know, the Japanese handbook, in which you get to play a ninja, which you couldn't previously do because there wasn't a class for it.
Yeah, but the jobs as well. I mean, you've got the idea that being a fighter is basically just someone who goes around murders people. You've got a thief who goes around stealing stuff from people. I mean, and you've got a priest or a cleric who
forgives the other team.
Yeah, constantly. That's why you need that in the team.
Okay, I'm the person around this table who knows least about this, and what I don't really understand is the game that you're involved. Any given set of teenagers are involved in. How does that actually start, and how is it that the people who created the game have any kind of purchase on how this game you're playing in your bedroom actually works out?
Well, the people who created the game have they had a purchase in that they sort of laid down the lore on how the game was meant to be played and would fulminate in the magazines devoted to the game that the game needed to be played in this particular way. But of course they actually had no control over whether it was.
And actually it wasn't, generally. I mean, lots of people just sat and go, I want to kill someone. Yeah.
If the sort of behaviour is called fantasy role-playing games, it seems to me like built into the title is at least the possibility that the people doing it will do something which is not going to be. I mean, that's kind of what fantasy is supposed
to be. I know, that's,
mean.
That's the tension.
But was there more tension there or less than you'd expect?
I think there was more. There was always a hell of a lot of tension, particularly as one of this kind of group of semi-socialised young teenagers would be appointed the referee. And then there'd be constant kind of to and fro's as to whether they are the referee or not, which is
so he's kind of teacher, and everyone else is yes, automatically the Bash Street Kids. Whether
they are automatically the Bash Street Kids. So for instance, I am nominally the presenter of this show. Pete is probably getting more airtime. Magnus, who is supposedly leading this bit of the conversation, has been kind of marginalised off over there. So perhaps we ought to give
my
him.
Am I working?
Yeah, no, it is on. I'll fade you down if I need to. And so it goes. Let me just start again on it. It goes into other genres as well. I mean, obviously this is a genre conversation again, and there are other genres of role playing game, and so this thing works there as well. And what happens later? And what happens? How do the games develop?
Well, you can progress within your character, so there are kind of strata within your the job that you've been given. And there's this idea that this would be create an automatic hierarchy between yourself and other characters. So you would maybe be the most experienced character, and you can carry characters over from one game to another. And
how much is it collaborative, and how much is it competitive?
It's in theory all collaborative, and in practice you are competing over who knows the game best and who is the sort of most experienced
player.
And
is it end focused or process focused?
No, it's all quite wishy washy.
again, it was invented before each other. Process focused existed. Yeah.
I mean, it's a topic of some interest to me. This actually, Magnus, in your job as a bouncy castle repairman, I understand you get to go somewhat incongruously to a lot of business meetings, and I wonder if. Sort of how reminiscent those meetings are of role-playing games?
Extraordinarily, actually. In fact, I'd say that of the things that I did socially when I was young, the one that has prepared me best for the world of Bouncy Castle conferences is knowing how to speak and how to improvise and contribute to panel discussions and so on. And one of the reasons that it's particularly appropriate is that I get the impression that there's a fair amount of bluffing going on in these conversations, and people sort of will probably know a fair amount about what they're talking about, but won't want to show themselves up as not actually understanding what other people are saying to them.
I can see that.
Is it fair to say that as the public school story was to the 19th century British Empire, the RPG is to the 21st century globalist capitalist?
If only that were true. I think it's probably too much for a tiny part of the world that's informing. So I suppose it is possible that it's more widespread, and that the proportion of school kids who went on to that is higher than their sort of like general demographic. But
Gygax is the mind behind Bush.
You'd be pushing it to really sort of say that was the definition of it all.
And Alex, is any holdover in your job?
No, not really.
Okay, well, there we go.
I just wasted my time at school playing these games, you know.
Yes, there is no deeper meaning. And now it only remains to announce the number one single for this week. Inspired by the abolition of hereditary peerages, the illegal downloaders of Great Britain have come together as one to elect as this week's chart topper the Jam's Eton Rifles. You have been listening to Magnus Anderson, Mark Sinker and Alex Thompson. Peter Barron has been our producer this week. You can find us on the internet at freakytrigger.co.uk, and this afternoon we'll be supping up our beer in the Pillars of Hercules pub, just as soon as we found our way out of this beastly maze. Stay tuned for Another Woman, all-female playlist selected by Ruth Barnes, followed by Calling All Pensioners and the Rocket 88 Do What Rock and Roll Show, which begins at 3. Today's show was brought to you by the words class. I'm Tom Ewing. Pip, pip, old stick, and thanks for listening.
Cause you were clever when you lit the fuse. Tore down the House of Commons in your brand new shoes. Come
was a revolutionary symphony that went to bed with a charming young thing.